Morning, Sam. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Portland City Council. We have a full agenda this morning, so we're going to begin. And before we begin the formal part of our presentation, each week we invite young people in to speak to council. In many countries in the world, when adults pass each other, they don't ask, how are you? They ask, how are the children? And that's one of the questions we continually have to ask ourselves is, how are the children? Because we know if the children in a community are well, if they have health care, they have a roof over their head, they have a full stomach and caring adults in their lives, they're much more likely to be successful, and thus the community is more successful. This morning, I'd like to welcome a scout troop to our celebration of young people. Brian Hohenstein and Anton Machek, could you come up? They're both Boy Scouts, and they're also students at Wilson High School. And they're joining us today in order to learn more about how the city works and how to earn credit toward a badge related to communication. Brian would like to address the council about an issue that's important to him and his fellow students. And Brian and Anton, I'd like to welcome you both. And could you also introduce the people you're with so they could stand up and we could recognize them?
Yeah. First, Braden Lambert, stand up. And then Scott Millison. And then who's back there? And then Nikki. And then who's behind the post over there?
Ben.
Oh, Ben Sherman's over there.
Thank you. Go ahead and just say your name when you speak, and it's your turn.
Hey, my name is Brian Hohenstein, and I'm going to be talking about how hard it is to take public transportation to my school. I live approximately 3.8 miles away from Wilson High School, and it takes me about 50 minutes to travel from my house to school. I have to walk about a mile every day with a 20-pound backpack on a highway with no sidewalks. There is a solution. I could take the 43 and get to school about half an hour early, but then I'd have to wake up at 5:30 every morning. I take the 44 once I walk a mile, and I get directly to school. I think that if they added a 43 time, then I could take the 43 from my house to the bus stop, and other kids in my neighborhood could also do that.
Thank you. Did you want to say anything?
I didn't really have anything. I'm kind of sick this morning.
Okay. So what will this do for your Boy Scout badge in terms of coming to council or city hall?
Our requirement for this badge was just come to a meeting, see how you guys function as a council, and take notes on the issues that you guys are discussing and the different sides of the issues and which of you guys support or reject the your sides on the issue.
Good. Well, very good. Well, we've got a lot of interesting issues today, so I hope you brought lots of pencils and paper.
Yeah.
Good. Well, let's give these young men and our Boy Scouts a hand.
Yeah.
Call City Council to order. Carla, please call the roll.
Adams?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Leonard? Saltzman?
Here.
Potter?
Here. I'd like to remind folks that prior to offering public testimony to City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity they are authorized to represent. Please read the first communication.
Item 1608, request of Carol Sima to address Council regarding Monta Villa in action.
Please come forward.
Good morning.
Good morning. And when you speak, please state your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes, Carol.
Okay. My name is Carol L. Sima, and I'll do this as quickly as I can. I am not a person seeking the limelight. I am a person who could not stand the situation we were living with. My husband and I have lived in our home for 38 years. This past year, we experienced an invasion into our community. We raised 4 children in our home. We have a bunch of wonderful grandchildren. In February of this year, we had a false spring. We had been working in our yard and had gone inside. My husband came to the back door and asked me to call the police. At 11 a.m. on Southeast 80th between Hawthorne and Clay, a couple were in the process of a sex act with the door of the truck they were in open. My husband saw the money change hands. We called the police. It would be the first of many calls. We became aware of the beginning of the great change in our neighborhood. The prostitution business really picked up on 82nd Avenue and was spilling over into our neighborhood. One day during spring school break, we had two granddaughters scheduled to come for lunch. They are 11 and 5. We planned a lunch on our front porch. As I carried our lunch out, the girls followed me, had to reverse and take them back into the house. Our house sits up above street level. How do you explain to a couple of kids that a guy is having a sex act performed on him at the curb in a car? Later in the spring, the same 11-year-old would play softball at Montevilla Park. These games would be preceded by volunteers sweeping the fields to remove condoms and needles. There was no let-up. The traffic circling off of 82nd onto the side streets. Hearing our area referred to as a red-light district was really a sad day. With the fact we were losing sleep due to constant circling, the screech of tires, and being told of the experiences of young women being harassed in the streets, we knew something had to be done. Our neighborhood group, Montevilla in Action, met and decided to petition the council to reinstate the prostitution-free zones. We knew this was a tool that the officers could use to help control the problem. We gathered signatures on the weekends at the farmers markets in Montevilla and in Lentz, and one volunteer canvassed businesses on 82nd from Stark to Division. In a short 2.5 months, the result was 1,500 signatures. As an activist in this neighborhood for 35-plus years, I know how caring my friends and neighbors are. I have called on them many times to back a project I was working on, from housing homeless people in my church to feeding needy families to helping me finance a softball team I was coaching. At this time, we are wondering why and how a treatment program will protect us from the invasion again. Good police work is what helped us this year, and we do appreciate that. Heavy patrols were very visible. Coverages brought things into control. It is commonly known that if we had an ordinance such as Seattle's SOAP in place for control of this criminal activity, maybe the pimps and prostitutes wouldn't migrate here again. How can we justify a treatment program for those who live on a near nomadic life and will, according to statistics, move on before they ever make it to court and enter a process? How long will the special cars be working the avenue? We have many questions unanswered. We feel an opportunity for a solution is being ignored. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Call the next.
Item 1609, request of Liz Sullivan to address council regarding Montevilla in Action.
Good morning.
State your name for the record, and you have 3 minutes.
Liz Sullivan. I, too, will try to be brief. It's hard to cram it all into 3 minutes. Good morning. My family and I live in Mount Tabor. In the late spring of this year, we started noticing more and more cars with prostitutes and johns parked in our neighborhood and engaging in the crime at all hours of the day and night. We all had to be on constant alert and chase away the numerous cars that we presumed stopped on our residential streets as they were originally heading towards Mount Tabor Park. We also started seeing more and more discarded condoms on the streets where we walked, in our parks, and in our children's schoolyards. When we drove along 82nd Avenue, we were both shocked and saddened to see this marked increase of these young women being freely and blatantly traded now on our streets in our city. These groups of women were now all up and down the avenue at any time of the day or night. It was difficult to just drive by them. It was as if the whole city was now enabling this crime to now thrive and flourish. We turned a blind eye to their daily suffering. So we got active and we got educated. What happened? What caused this new critical level of crime in our communities? What was apparent to all was that at the root of this increased escalation in crime was the city's abandonment of the prostitution-free zone on September 30th, 2007. We researched the history and timeline of the PFZ, and you can see in the handout there on page 2, there's a consistent timeline where we were shocked at how the PFZ was lumped with the drug-free zone and that the city's commissioned research for abandoning both ordinances only researched the drug-free zone. In the entire 18-page research report done by the city, the word prostitution was not mentioned once, yet both ordinances were allowed to sunset. This, to us, was the priority reason, number one, as to why the PFZ should be reinstated based on this now obvious and blatant example of cause and effect exploding right before our eyes in our neighborhoods. These criminals are now testing our neighborhoods and our city to see how much we will tolerate. Look at how proactive they were. They saw the opportunity with the PFZ now being absent and made our neighborhoods their new business district. We need to be even more proactive and not reactive like the city was in the late summer and the early fall months of this year. With the tightening budgets of 2009, we have to be more strategic about our efforts in truly addressing this crime. In our rebuttal back to the mayor's proposal in early September, we question if this budget is slated for the increased missions and the detail cars, and if we have money for next year, and to what level. We also stress this idea of community policing and court watch should not be one of the four main pillars. The working class family of the Montevilla Community Foot Patrol were patrolling this summer 7 nights a week due to necessity. They do not want that same urgent need to still be there come the springtime. We do not have that mentality of not in my backyard. We don't want any other community to be overtaken by this crime. It breaks our hearts, and now our neighborhood women and young girls do not feel safe. They're being approached and harassed by both pimps and johns, those same pimps that are making these other young women and girls walk our neighborhood streets. We do not want this tolerated in any neighborhood. We also strongly suggest why the city is not focused on the demand, the johns. Please see page 5 of the handout for research done by activist Melissa Farley on why this is key. This should be one of the four pillars to the mayor's proposal. This needs to be a consistent and targeted effort focused on them. This also needs to be communicated by the city that this crime will not be tolerated, and if you are arrested, that numerous steps will be taken against you. Why not activate proven effective tactics that over 280 U.S. cities employ when dealing with johns that have proven to work? List them on a website. Put them in the paper.
Ma'am, your time is up.
Okay. Can I just quickly?
One sentence.
Okay. Make them do work crew. There are many inexpensive and effective punishments to this crime. The goal of this zone is the next best thing to rehabilitation of the offender. That is the rehabilitation of the area and the community.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you. Sorry.
Item 1610, request of Joanne Conzen to address council regarding tenant, landlord, property manager rights and responsibilities.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please state your name and you speak. You have 3 minutes.
Joanne Conzen. I am here with a solution today, and I'm hoping to, my intention is basically to plant a few seeds in getting the process started. Of course, preceding that is the problem. I was a renter for a couple of years in a property managed by Bowen Property Management. They undertook what they called a renovation. They offered no information to the tenants as to what they could anticipate beyond 1 week of entry into the units. It ended up being Monday through Friday every day for over 5 months. We had no way to resolve the problems. There were no phone numbers that I contacted on the tenant-landlord guidelines that allowed any problem solving in the issue. I had experienced loss of income. The story goes on. So my solution is, based on experience in other communities in which I lived, is to establish a rent board, very clear-cut rent board. It would offer mediation services that would relieve the courts of the burdens that they already have in the system. The process of hiring attorneys would not be a huge burden to tenants. Now, this is also information for new landlords, established landlords, to find guidelines on how to proceed with any kind of problems or processes that they want to undertake. The beauty of it requires no taxpayer funds. It's always worked in communities in which I've lived that each tenant would pay $1 per month. It's $12 a year, and that would be matched by the property management companies. So essentially $24 per tenant per year. And I think from my experience, that would fund the rent board beautifully. It's always been an experience that it's resolved problems. Now, in the process of the so-called renovation, it would have had the ability to stop the process in its tracks. It would have required that all tenants be talked to about the process of the renovation and given the option to stay or move. And it's really unbelievable that they were able to get away with the process that they did.
Hansen, can I just respond?
Sure.
We took up last week the recommendations of a work group, the Quality Rental Housing Work Group, that was a comprehensive framework for enhancing the rights of tenants and for addressing problems as they come up. I don't think this concept made its way into the package, but as the housing commissioner, I'd like to know more about it. So if you could just, before you go, drop off anything you have in our office.
Absolutely.
And we'll get back to you. But we also want you to take a look at that study group's recommendations and be interested in your thoughts. Okay.
Now, my proposal would be statewide because I did find that small, you know, within a county, it became problematic when people moved outside
right.
of the area. And I also wanted to add, if I could, just briefly, given the economic times, it would also be fair to have some kind of a rent management because they typically, when the lease expires, raise rent well beyond 5% up to 10%, and the tenant has no way of anticipating this kind of renting.
Well, the theme that you've raised about resolving these disputes outside of the courts and getting quicker relief and fairer outcomes is something the council is already on record as supporting, so I'd be interested in knowing
Great.
More
okay.
about your idea.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Be the next.
1611, request of Carolyn Fuller to address council regarding two city workers.
Thank you for being here. When you speak, state your name for the record. You have 3 minutes.
My name is Carolyn Fuller, and I'm here to explain a horrendous process that's been taking place at my home. In mid-October or early November, the city engineer came out to my front corner and was surveying the area and writing down notes and checking out what's going on. And I ran outside, I said, are you the person that's going to help us solve this flooding problem? And he said, well, yes, we are going to be changing the sewer, and I'm just out here finding out what it looks like and what the slopes are in order to be able to make up a plan. And this is on the corner of Kirby and Fremont, and it's the northwest corner. We've had 35 years of flooding there, according to the record of the longest living person there, person who's lived there the longest. And I've had this experience for 13 years that I've lived there. I've had to go out and unstop the sewer numerous times because there's a huge flood between my corner and the other corner, and the children are trying to get to school across the street. November 14th, I signed a contract to have a wall built, on a retaining wall built, because my corner was the source of a great deal of erosion and a great deal of soil being dumped into the sewer. And on November 15th, I amended our contract to add, and it was for a wall that was to be about 3 feet high. And at the time that we, November 17th, we finalized it at a height of 3 feet. And in the meantime, I called the sidewalk department and the sewer engineer and set a meeting and wanted to set a meeting between the two of them. I called their offices and I wanted to set a meeting between the engineer and the sewer person because I realized that putting my wall in might have an impact on what was going on, and I knew that the sidewalk needed to be changed in order to avoid the flooding, so I asked to meet with both of them. The only person that appeared was the sidewalk man, and after protracted, very, very unpleasant encounter with him, in which I was treated as if I was about 15 years old and with an IQ of about 50, he refused to acknowledge the fact that his sidewalk was concave and that there was puddle formed here and a puddle formed there and it would spill over, taking all the soil. So he would not take any action. This, I don't care the hell with this project. I don't give a damn. He either said, No, I don't care the hell about this project, or I don't give a damn what you're doing here. But this damn sidewalk is never being changed. It meets federal code. and he would not comply with this. 20 minutes later, someone from the construction inspector's office came and issued a permit or violation of code. The contractor went to speak to the code person. He says, ah, no, just move the wall back. It's not a big deal.
Ma'am, your time is up.
And then I've gotten no recourse.
Did you have a copy of your information and give the council clerk?
Do I have a...
Do you have a copy of the what you've just said so that we could look at it?
Yes.
Okay, good.
It's going to be hard to read.
Well, if you gave the council clerk your contact information, we could have the bureaus contact you.
And I'd also like to add that my experience in Commissioner Sam Adams' office, and I think it's interesting that he has left the room, but in my treatment in that office, the people were condescending and obsequious. Sam Adams himself spoke to me in an incredibly obsequious, condescending tone of voice and spoke to me also, as the city inspector had spoke to me, like I was someone who is 10 or 15 years old, maybe 6 years old.
Your time is up.
And was
ma'am,
a bore.
Your time is up. Thank you. Call the next.
Item 1612, request of Sharon Nassett to address council regarding food banks.
Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Sharon Nassett, and happy Thanksgiving. It'll be here very, very soon, and 4 days off. I mean, banker's holiday is what that used to be called. I am here to speak about two things, and one is a written piece of paper, and I will just leave it with you. And it has to do with foreclosures and mortgages and what we can do as a state and organizations that we already currently have that can step in place taking care of foreclosures in our area and take care of handling, keeping our properties more local and out of secondary market. But the food banks and pantries are stuck in the same type of cycle that the people that come to use the food banks are stuck in. They never have enough. They're always trying to catch. They're always trying to run up. And they're always looking for and in a negative situation. And our food banks and our pantries, as you know, in Oregon, we have some of the nation's highest as far as children and adults, although we're in the breadbasket of the world. A lot of it is taking a look at reorganizing it. Not only what we as citizens can do, and there's many things to bring things to the pantry, but if the city council took a look at the pantries and the soup kitchens and decided exactly how much it would take to meet their needs for an entire year, how many pounds of food is it that we don't have to cut back on the boxes, so we know what we are looking at. By setting up an actual goal, we can ask different people to donate money, as well as actually set up things where we're saying we're closer and closer now to meeting the goal of actually having not only enough food on the shelf for this year, but have 2 years ample ahead. Right now, we kind of leave it to the federal government and to the do-gooders. But the bottom line is that the people that are hungry, the children that are hungry, are our citizens. They are the same people that are next to us. The phrase that the poor will always be with us was not meant to make us feel helpless. It was to inspire us to do something that was permanent. There are several things we can do besides just feeding, but at the very least, that is what we need to do. And you have good leadership here and very good hearts. If we know exactly the dollar amount to take care of feeding and funding all the soup kitchens and pantries, we would have a mark to aim towards. Perhaps we could have continual marathons until we reach those lines and then get us ahead. How wonderful it would be when you see people on a corner with a sign that says, I'm hungry. If you could hand him a card that says, here are local soup kitchens and foods. And when you go there, they're not going to say, we're out of food, slide down the wall and wait. We open back up in 2 hours like they do now. or cut back, as St. Vincent's has had to do. We usually in North Portland have a pantry that gives out a couple hundred a month. They've had to cut back to 88 boxes because they don't have enough, and they turn people away every week. So if you could also take a look at the foreclosure information I have on how Oregon can step forward and actually take our properties into our own hands. It's always best to climb out of the hole before you reach bottom. Thank you, and have a lovely holiday.
Thank you.
Thank you for what you do to feed our hungry. The latest stat that I saw is that there's 117,000 children in the state of Oregon that go to bed hungry at night, and I think that should be unacceptable to our state.
I couldn't agree more, and what I really believe is if we actually had a dollar amount of what it would take to feed our do our soup kitchens and our pantries and then did a step up. And I would also like to remind people, besides bringing in food, money is actually a better thing to bring in because you've bought that can of food secondary, paid for all of the costs. When you give them dollar amounts, they buy food by the pound, and it's much and it goes much further. So a few fundraisers in that direction with your leadership would be wonderful.
And you'll be pleased to know that in a team effort, the council is working on individual pieces of a response to the recession, and we'll be coming out with that in January. So,
good.
Thanks. Thanks for your, as always, ahead of the game.
Oh, well, thanks. Your leadership's wonderful. Have a good holiday.
Thank you. Is that the last communication?
That's the last, yes.
Okay. Now move to the consent agenda. Do any commissioners wish to pull any items from the consent agenda? Does any member of this audience wish to pull any particular item from the consent agenda? Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Please read the 9:30 time certain.
Item 1613, Mayor's Delegation to Matare, Zimbabwe, Sister City.
We've had a sister city relationship with Matare, Zimbabwe since 1991. Cliff Walker was one of the founders of it, but it provides a valuable service to the people of Matare. They've helped build a clinic, they support a school and an orphanage, and they give supplies to community organizations. This is the first year, however, that the City of Portland has sent an official delegation from Portland, and it was led by Maria Cosmatatis, president of the Portland Matare Sister City Association and founder of Africa AIDS Response, Dana Kirk, a longtime volunteer with the Sister City Association, Cliff Walker, founder of the Sister City Relationship, Myla Grison, former International Relations Director for Portland, and Austin Raglione, my chief of staff, who was representing me there. With that, I'd like to invite Maria up.
Thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Maria Cosmatatis. I'm the president of the Portland Matare Sister City Association, and I'm a nurse practitioner. I work in the HIV clinic at Multnomah County and have been there for the past 13 years since I moved to Portland. I really want to thank you on behalf of all of our volunteers. We are an entire volunteer organization in the Sister City, and especially for all of our delegates that are here today for honoring us and allowing us to be here. We're very excited to be able to present briefly a little bit about our trip and about what we do. Our hope today is to give you a little bit of history, a little bit of background about the association, what we strive to do as a sister city and building relationships across these large borders that we have, and show you some images and stories from our trip. We hope to do this in somewhat of a tag team approach so that you don't get bored with just listening to me talk for a few minutes. And we hope that each one of us will be sharing something that's been dear to us, either through the relationship or through this delegation. My portion, now as one of the elders, as I say, of the association, especially after this trip, along with Cliff, will be to talk a little bit about the history and the development of the association very briefly, as well as what we do with the development of Africa AIDS Response, which is a program of the Portland Matare Sister City Association, to talk a little bit about the current efforts that we have. But before we do that, what we wanted to show you was a very brief 3-minute video that we made in 2006 to show at our World AIDS Day benefit that we have annually on World AIDS Day, which is upcoming. And it was designed to really outline and highlight the dedication of the clinic that was built and dedicated in 2005. Hopefully, the music and the images from this video will frame the rest of our presentation today.
What shall we do?
Ding-a-ding.
What shall we do?
Thank you. My name is Clifford Walker, and I have had the pleasure and honor of being one born in Portland and being a resident of Portland for most of my life. And I guess that's how you can say I got involved in the building of a sister city association. To be brief, I just want to thank the city of Portland for making it possible for the citizens of Portland to build goodwill with the cities of Mutare, Zimbabwe. some 17 years ago, I witnessed a coming together of the mayor of Mutare in this council with the former mayor, Bud Clark. And I thank them again for their foresight of broadening Portland's international profile by encouraging the people of Portland to reach out into the world and develop connections that could prove, that could grow. I really short for words other than I'm humbled by the citizens of Portland's reaching out to the people of Mutare, Zimbabwe, and having been a part of that outreach for 17 years, just to say thank you for making it possible for people of Portland to experiencing things that they can only experience through municipal exchanges. Thank you so much.
So to briefly tell you a little bit about the programs that we do, we thank you for watching the video. It's one of our favorite things. It was put together by one of our volunteer members. As Cliff said, the sister city was founded in 1991, and in 2000, the program Africa AIDS Response was founded, basically by a group of Portlanders who really wanted to address the international pandemic of HIV and to support grassroots AIDS efforts there. Again, another fortuitous connection was I met Mike Lindberg, who happened to tell me that we had a sister city in Zimbabwe prior to my wanting to go for a couple of months for the first time to spend some time in Africa. With that connection, I called up Cliff. A group of us, all volunteers, people with HIV, community activists, put together our first benefit in the year 2000 called Hope is Vital. That one was just actually called Africa AIDS Response. We went on our first trip after having a sellout at the Crystal Ballroom of 1,000 people and raising $20,000. I went to Zimbabwe in hopes of being able to work in a clinic that was there in the small community of St. Werburgh's, where Veronica worked, Veronica Nyoni, who you saw in those pictures that Cliff made that connection with back in 1991. Unfortunately, there wasn't a clinic there. It had had many troubles over the past 25 years with the citizens there trying to build a clinic. So I didn't actually do that, but was able to leave the seed money to get that started. Since that time, we have raised and delivered over $120,000 to the community and also have had at least 5 delegations visit during that time. It is primarily in rural Zimbabwe where we make this connection. And again, every time we go, we say we're here representing the people of Portland. They always very much feel it's the whole city and the whole community that represents them or represents us, even though it might be only one or two, or in this case, 19 people who actually visit Zimbabwe. We have 3 main primary focuses. Those are the primary health care, of which you saw the clinic, orphan support, and support for people living with HIV. For the past 8 years, the clinic was the major thing that was developed over that time. We provide supplies. We provide different medications when we come. We're able to, this past year, actually purchase an ambulance, which is essentially a pickup truck with a shell. But the ambulance has been able to provide transport for people living in very rural areas to the clinic and then from the clinic into the city hospital when they need to get there. A waiting mother's shelter was built over the last year, which provides shelter for women who are pregnant, who walk to the clinic to deliver and wait outside and historically under a tree for the last month or so before they deliver their child so they can deliver in the clinic because they're so excited that it's there. So we were able to fund that over the past year, as well as started support of a small project to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV this past year. In terms of orphan support, this has been one of our hallmarks in terms of the most important things for us over the past years. They've actually doubled in terms of the numbers that you saw on that video in the last 2 years. We provide school fees, we provide food, books, supplies, uniforms, and most importantly, I think that food, primarily because some of these kids only get one meal a day and they actually get it when they go to school. The third area is the support for people living with HIV. And that's in the terms of the main supports of FOSSO, which is the Family AIDS Support Organization. This is primarily an organization of women with HIV, though there are a few men who also have HIV. They make these beautiful panels which support themselves. This is to support a microeconomic project. We buy them directly from the men and women there who make them, who have HIV. When we provide them with the money on the days that they are there, they actually have the money in their hands to buy food. They actually have the money to pay for their children's school fees. This one says, "It takes a planet to save a village," which has been one of our our tagline since we started in 2000. And the second tagline that we always use is hope is vital. That came from one of the first women I talked to at FOSSA in 2000 when I asked them what they wanted to say to people with HIV in Portland. And they said, hope is vital. And so that has been one of our main messages that we have tried to provide. Our local Portland efforts have been pen pals that have gone back and forth from the students here in Oregon and in particularly in Portland to Zimbabwe. We do presentations and outreach to schools and community groups, anybody who wants to hear what we have to say, because as you can see, we could talk about it for hours. Last year, we also sent a shipment in conjunction with OHSU of supplies and medications and computers, both to the city and to the rural areas. And lastly, what I hope to call your attention to is the beautiful mural that's on the corner of Northeast Broadway and Grand. If you haven't seen it, you need to drive by. It's on the corner of the Rhythm Traders Drumming Store, and it says very largely, it takes a planet to save a village, hope is vital, and has pictures now that you'll recognize of kids and people dancing around and outside of the clinic. So briefly, that's what we intend to do and hope to continue to do, and thank you for your support in that. I want to now introduce the delegates who went on the trip. So if you could all stand. Each of these came, each of these people came with really unique qualities and contributed so much to this trip, I can't tell you. I think I have to sit here and kind of turn so that I can stay with the microphone. So you guys will have to wave since I can't see you on the side. So our leadership was with Dana Kirk Morrison here, who actually wrangled us all and got us there, a long-term volunteer with us. Clifford Walker, the founder, Karen Hansen, who became the mayoress on our trip. That was her name quickly given to her by Veronica, the mayoress. Myla Greeson. Is Myla here? I didn't see her. Oh, Myla's not here. And Austin Raglione, the chief of staff. These were our fearless leaders. There were two of us that represented the medical care, and that was myself as a nurse practitioner and Dr. Mary O'Hearn, who works at OHSU, who isn't here today because she is working in clinic at OHSU. Our HIV educators were Jerry Johnson and John Motter. And John, who is a person living with HIV, was our representation of bringing someone in solidarity to meet them in Mutare. Our resident musician was Benny Morrison. And as you can see, music and dance is such an important part of the community in Zimbabwe, and Benny connected in every way you can imagine in terms of music. And he actually recorded several songs while we were there and has come back and made a CD of the music of Zimbabwe, especially the people that we have met. Our photographer, is John here? John's not here. Oh, that's right. They're on vacation. They went to Thanksgiving. John Greeson, who is Myla's husband, was our resident photographer and videographer, so that he took 1,100 photos, I think, on our trip. We had two wonderful teachers with us, and it was the first time we were able to bring teachers, Trisha Todd and Lisa O'Brien. No, teaching. You know, teaching. These people have to do their jobs. So this was really a landmark for us to bring teachers. And then most importantly, and for me, what made the trip was bringing the students. And so I'm going to name their names, and they're going to shout out. It was Isabel Riddick, Claire McClellan, Andre Walker, Gabrielle Raglione, Maddie Hanlon Austin, and Trey Ford. And they're all going to talk to you a little bit from now. So with that, what I'd like to do is introduce Dana, who's going to tell you a little bit about our trip. She, again, was the coordinator of our trip and has in the past been our volunteer executive director and very dedicated to what we do.
Thank you. So my name is Dana Kirk Morrison, and I'm going to set the tone for all the kids that are come up and speaking, but I wanted to talk about what's going on in Zimbabwe right now. Not only is 19 people a very difficult number for us to manage when we're used to 4 or 5, but Zimbabwe has a lot of challenges that are going on that even we couldn't foresee. So one of it is the bank system. Right now, the day we arrived on a Monday, it was 25,000 Zimbabwe dollars to one U.S. dollar, and that was after they had taken 10 zeros off the currency in the beginning of September. The day we left, it was 65,000 Zimbabwe dollars to one U.S. dollar, and that was on a Friday. So within 1 week, it had almost tripled. What it is today, I can't even begin to guess as far as what the money is worth. At the same time, the government put a lock on all funds you can withdraw from a bank, and you can only withdraw 50,000 Zim dollars a day. So you can only withdraw less than a dollar a day for your family for food, and all those who are employed, which is only about 20% of the population, all of their money goes into the banking system. They don't get paid out in cash. It's a way of the government controlling the funds. Average salary is for a teacher is 91,000 Zimbabwe dollars per month, which is why all of the teachers and medical professionals and everyone has been on strike for about the last month or so, because they're not getting paid enough to feed their families. And even if they had money in the banks, they're not getting enough money out. At the same time, the cost of produce has skyrocketed because no one knows how much it's going to cost from one day to the next. In grocery stores, you buy things in U.S. dollars and in Zimbabwe dollars. A bottle of water costs $4 U.S. It was just a ridiculous pricing scheme because no one knows how to make sense of anything. This is not a very good photo because we're not supposed to take pictures of this, but somebody did. But I wanted to show it to you because it's the lines outside the banks. There's about hundreds of people outside of every single bank in the city waiting for money for their families. So everywhere we drove, this is what we saw, was just lines of people waiting to only take out 50,000 Zimbabwean dollars a day for food. Do you want to go to the next? A lot of people are taking their money and they're walking to Mozambique, which is only about 3 miles from the city of Mutare, to buy goods in Mozambique, and then they sneak across the borders at night and walk at night. And so this is in the morning, watching them carrying food. I believe the next photo. And other materials such as a chainsaw. This woman has a chainsaw on her head that she is carrying back from Mozambique for supplies to bring to her family because they're not available anymore in the country. So just another picture of the women with the supplies that they're carrying, because even those stores, the only stores that have produce for you to buy are owned and operated by South Africa. So there's the Spar Market, which is where I did all of our shopping for the trip to get snacks and food for us. But most stores have empty grocery store shelves and have closed, and so most people can't afford to go to the Spar Market. So there's, if you want to actually go back one, sorry. There is the challenges of this bank lines and lack of the ability to get water. Transportation and fuel was also a big challenge. We were helped out by Mercy Corps, who is headquartered in Portland but has a lot of operations in Mutare, and they are a friendly organization that we work side by side with. They were able to help us get fuel coupons. That's the other challenge, is even if you had a car, the average person can't buy fuel because you have to get fuel coupons from the government to be able to get fuel. And it's these little coupons that you buy, and it's $1.25 per liter. And so you pre-buy it. But we still had to drive to 4 different petrol stations to find one that was willing to accept our fuel coupons from the government. It's just this constant challenge and constant difficulties of what's going on in that country. And I don't know if you've been paying attention to the media, but Jimmy Carter and Nelson Mandela have been trying to go in on a humanitarian mission and have not been able to right now. And it's because of the sister city relationship and the city of Mutare that we were able to do this trip at this time and get the needed goods to the people. With that being said, it's a challenging place, but it is a place of the strongest, most wonderful, and most lively people. When we first arrived, this is after flying 35 hours, driving for 8 hours. We show up, the sun is setting, to the Family Aid Support Organization, which is a group of HIV-positive men and women. It's a membership organization. They're the ones that make the panel. And as they drove in, and I was actually in a separate car, the bus was surrounded by hundreds of people who had been waiting 6 hours for us because we were on Zimbabwe time and arrived 6 hours late. But they had been waiting for 6 hours just to see us. And it's that human-to-human connection that makes it so powerful. We brought 1,800 pounds of donations with us. Each person had 2 50-pound bags each, 100 pounds of donations that were brought. And yet it was the people that made the biggest impact. Us being there brought hope. It brought this human-to-human connection that is so difficult to express in words. This is just some of the luggage and things that we brought. You'll notice there's 3 bike boxes. Portland's a city of bikes, so of course we took bikes with us to Zimbabwe. What they use them for is the catchment area of St. Warburg's is about 15,000 people, and there's a chief and there's six sub-chiefs. And they station the bicycles at each of the sub-chiefs' houses around the community so that if there's an emergency, someone can hop on a bicycle, ride to the clinic to get the ambulance, so the ambulance can go pick somebody up. They also are going to use some of the bicycles for teachers to go to the remote areas to run impromptu classrooms. So the bikes are this big deal, so we brought them. They were received with much excitement. The day after we had left them off, the kids had lined up to ride the bikes, and they started a bike club so all the kids could learn to ride a bicycle in the middle of rural Zimbabwe. And so with this joy, there's also this balance of sorrow that characterized much of our trip. Veronica Nione, who's the headmistress of the church, of the school, pulled me aside and she said, "Do you mind if I keep the boxes?" And so I'm thinking, gosh, I'm a really bad American because I would have just thrown the boxes away. I wouldn't have thought about the boxes. And so she said, "I really would like to keep the boxes." And I said, "Sure, of course you can have the boxes." And she said, "Well, we need the boxes so that we can create coffins for the orphans. Too many kids are dying and don't have families to give them a proper burial. Would you mind if we use them? We've made a cemetery next to the playground on the primary school that the teachers are burying the orphans in, and they're using the boxes that we brought that we had thought of as trash or something to be recycled, as something that was so central to give the dead the respect that they deserve." So there was this balance back and forth that was going on that made it a very challenging trip, I think, for all of the delegates. Because at one moment you're singing and dancing, at the next moment you're hearing these stories that are unfathomable from kind of our Western perspective. And so with that, I want to introduce the kids to kind of share some of those stories and tell you in their words what kind of struck them and what were the pieces of the trip that they brought home with them. I know that they've been speaking at their schools and sharing the stories, but they wanted to have that opportunity here. So Maddie's going to be the first one to talk.
We just talked in here. Okay. Hi, I'm Maddie Hamlin Austin, and I'd just like to thank you guys for this opportunity, this life-changing experience that I've had, for letting me be able to go on that, and all of us. I know that I'm speaking for all of us. But so the first day that we were there, the second day actually, we went to St. Augustine's Orphanage, and it was really the first day that we got to interact and meet with any of the kids in Zimbabwe. And while it was heartbreaking and tragic at the same time, it was also enlightening and life-changing. Some of the kids there are 28 kids living in the orphanage, and then they're fortunate enough to have a roof over their heads and beds to sleep in. They are also facing some of the greatest struggles that all the people in Zimbabwe are facing, which is lack of food. Their storage room, which I don't think we have a picture of, but they have 6 potatoes left to feed 28 kids and about this much salt and cooking oil to cook with. And it's just, despite the fact that they haven't eaten in days, they still were just gracious and courteous, and they were smiling, and they were so happy, and they were radiating this joy that I'd never seen before. And it was really eye-opening. And here we are, we're giving them stuffed animals. We brought stuffed animals, was the only thing that we had for them at the St. Augustine's Orphanage. And as we pass them out among these kids ranging in age from 5 to 22 years old, they clung to these stuffed animals, and no matter what size they were, even big or small, they weren't complaining. They were just radiating happiness. And that's a picture, I think, next picture. It's hard to see. Caroline was one of the girls that I really connected with, this small 5-year-old girl who is now showing signs of HIV and AIDS, and there is no medication for children. They can't afford to give these kids medication, and so they don't think that she'll live to be over 8 years old. And it's just tragic to think that I had this connection with this little girl, this brilliant child who, even though she didn't speak English, I felt like I could just relate to her completely, that if I was to ever go back to Zimbabwe, she might not be there. And we gave her a blanket from the Women of Wisdom, which is an HIV organization here in Portland. And they gave her that quilt just to share with one of the children there, over there, that had HIV as well. And so it was kind of establishing that connection, which is what we wanted, which was one of the goals of our trip. So, yeah. Thank you.
So I'm Gabby Raglione, and thank you for having us here today, too. So when we first, this is us first arriving to St. Werburgh's, where Veronica Neone, she's the headmistress of the primary school. And when we arrived, the kids were all running alongside the bus, and it just made that our arrival that much extra special for us, because it's just that authenticity that everybody in Zimbabwe has. And we were greeted by music everywhere, but to me, this was probably my favorite, just because Catherine, that woman in the middle, she's the music director at St. Werburgh. She was really, really one of probably my favorite people to meet, and it was really just great to see a big group of kids singing to us, and I had that connection, and they also danced for us, which was really great. We brought a lot of donations with us, obviously, and to St. Werburgh's we brought sports supplies. So we brought soccer balls and jerseys and stuff, and the kids have on Lincoln shorts and Grant jerseys. So if you know anything about high school sports, big rivalry there. It's funny that trip to Zimbabwe had to bridge that rivalry gap, but got it done. All the students got to play soccer with the kids, and the kids are barefoot. They don't really have any shoes, but they're really great soccer players. It's unbelievable how well they play, and it's just, I mean, I wish I could play like them, but. let's see. Oh, so in this picture, Karin is with the cutouts of Maddie and Mackenzie, her grandkids. And in the picture, you can kind of see some kids holding food containers, because that day food came from the federal government to St. Werburgh's, and there had been no food at the school for a month. So, but mostly it was because of our presence that the government brought food, because they wanted to, in a way, just sort of mask Zimbabwe's current situation and have us not see that true disparity that they have there. So it was just by our presence that those kids got food. So that was just another privilege to see. So. Go ahead, Claire.
Okay, so I'm Claire McClellan, and I'm in seventh grade. And I'm going to talk about the chief. Well, the chief is the man with the blue hat and the beard, and the man standing next to him is Isaiah, and the woman who's about to hug Maria is Sina. They're the two that are sort of like next in charge after Veronica of St. Werburgh's. And the chief's name is Chigidora Zamunya. He is the chief of the Zamunya tribal land, and it's St. Werburgh's is on that land, and that's why he's here in the picture. Yeah. Okay, so this is Austin and Veronica with the chief, with the plate that they gave him. It has the dove and the St. Werburgh's mission on it. Izzy and I got to talk with the chief a bit, and he was really excited to talk with us. He thought it was pretty cool. He was really nice, and he was excited, and he wants us to send him this picture so he can see us with him. And since I was a girl and the youngest member of the delegation, I got to present him with his gifts. It's a hat, a plate, and a tie, and he loves hats, and it's also a status symbol. And the plate Austin made, and the tie had roses on it for the City of Roses. And, can you go back? Thank you. So when I presented it to him, I had to kneel and bow my head because it's a symbol of respect and, respect. So this is the mural on Rhythm Traders. It's the Hope is Vital, and it takes place at Save a Village. On the far right, there is the chief. And then on the left, well, actually, in the very middle, standing in front of the clinic, behind everyone singing and dancing,